From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. On the show today, lessons about an arena debate from a mayor who went through four of them. Then, why a sports arena doesn't automatically mean prosperity for a city.
If it's not part of a better plan that has a little bit broader and longer-term horizon, then there is no economic benefit for having a sports facility or a local team.
And a documentary film introduces us to three people having an outsized impact on hunger around them.
One person can actually make a big difference through inspiring other people. So it's that idea that our impact can be greater than our individual action, sometimes without us even knowing it.
And Melinda Myers helps us get the spring planting season off to an informative start. Lake Effect next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. From literally the second he was elected mayor of Minneapolis to the time he left office 12 years later, R.T. Ryback was constantly in the middle of debates about new sports arenas. Under his watch, a new baseball stadium went up for the Twins, a new football stadium was constructed for the University of Minnesota, an aging basketball arena was renovated, and plans put in place for a new NFL stadium. And while each was marked by controversy, Ryback maintained a strong measure of popularity throughout. So as he watches a similar debate unfold about a Milwaukee basketball arena, it's not surprising Ryback has some thoughts about the process. We caught up with him last month as he was preparing to talk to the annual meeting of the Greater Milwaukee Committee. R.T. Ryback, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here. I love Milwaukee.
You had been in office for literally about 5 minutes when the news came that the Twins were likely to be eliminated from Major League Baseball if a new stadium plan wasn't in place. This was back in, I think it was the late 90s. Where was the effort when you took office, and what had to happen from a public perspective to move things forward?
When I came in, the Twins stadium was in general agreement that something needed to be done, but it was very, very unclear what we should do. And there was this challenge everybody has. They want the team to stay. They don't want to pay for it. They believe there's a reason that political leaders should get something done, but they recognize what I feel is very true, which is pro sports economics are really sick. Do you engage in a process that's imperfect, or do you stand back and unfortunately watch market forces turn you into a city you don't want to be? It's tough stuff.
And you sort of opt out at your own peril?
I think, unfortunately, yes. And my learning over 12 years was to engage in the process. It's important for a town, especially Milwaukee, to keep the bucks. But it's also important to negotiate really tough on behalf of the public. And I think if you craft a very pragmatic approach saying, look, we want to keep the team, we want to upgrade a facility that's clearly not as competitive, but we are not going to be chumps at the hands of sports owners, I think you can craft something that works.
Well, and perhaps the more apples-to-apples comparison is what had to happen to upgrade the Target Center, right?
Right. In the case of Target Center, a basketball arena that was built in the 80s, it was clearly not competitive anymore. We needed to upgrade it. In that case, we came up with a very pragmatic strategy, which was to upgrade the building as it is, about $100 million renovation. It's in a little better shape than the stadium here, but not much. And that was a smart, pragmatic approach. In the case of the Metrodome, the football stadium, we chose to tear that down and to build a new, really spectacular stadium. But in both cases, we negotiated tough for the public. And we also said, look, we're happy if this team does well. But if you make money, because we added value because of the stadium, we get to claw back some of the potential in that. So in both the basketball and the football situations, if the team is sold in the short period of time and they make more money, we're happy for them, but the public gets some of that money back.
One of the phenomena that is wrapped up in the Milwaukee arena debate, especially now that the rest of the state is part of the mix, is ambivalence or downright hostility towards Milwaukee from far-flung places in Wisconsin. You know, you live in Eau Claire or Superior, and you say, well, why should we do anything to make things better for Milwaukee? Was there a similar dynamic in Minnesota, and how did you counter that?
There is always a dynamic in every state where what happens in the big city draws resentment from other parts of the state, while, frankly, other parts of the state often benefit from that. The fact of the matter is there are some great, great communities around Detroit, but the fact that that center city isn't doing well has a negative impact on the rest. We're all tied together. And there is pretty clear to me that there are people from outside of the city limits of Milwaukee at a Bucks game, or certainly watching them on television. I know from living across the border from you guys that it's pretty clear that there are people in the western part of the state who happen to like your baseball, basketball, and football teams, even though they don't happen to be in that community. And the whole state is involved. Now, it's really important for the city to recognize that if you're going to get partnership from all out there, you have to do it in a way that benefits everyone. But the fact of the matter is all of Wisconsin is part of this.
You know, Minneapolis is similar to Milwaukee in many ways, and many large cities for that matter. When people talk about amenities like a football stadium or a basketball arena or a convention center, these are facilities that get used by people in the suburbs or even in these far-flung parts of the state. And yet the city is in a position of needing to find ways to get these facilities built and still deal with all the other things that a big city has to deal with. What was your attitude towards that balancing act of, you know, this is a facility that the people in the suburbs go and they pay a lot of money and then they go home at night, and there are still these issues going on in the other parts of the city?
It's clear that within the boundaries of the city of Milwaukee, or frankly any city of this size, you have many, many complex issues, schools and transportation and infrastructure and all these issues, and some of them are the direct responsibility of the people who live there. But a large city, especially the largest in the state, also has a huge shadow effect on the rest of the state. There are direct examples like keeping Northwestern Mutual here, growing here, having those employees pay taxes primarily, I bet, in the suburbs, the real estate taxes that are paid that benefit the rest of the state. All of that really is part of a mix. What you have to do with a big city is use it as your economic driver. It's a place where having that big business have their employees go down the street to the basketball game keeps them grounded here, which has their families, buildings in the suburbs and all of that. It's all wound together. What you also have to recognize, and I think Wisconsin and especially Milwaukee have to think a lot about the fact that right now talent is very, very mobile. We're coming into a worker shortage, and that period of time is going to say that people can work wherever they want. And Milwaukee is in a fight for talent. And you look at that and you think about going to Chicago, going to Minneapolis, St. Paul, going to Denver, even going to Detroit, which is now beginning to move a little bit here, and certainly other parts of the country. You have to keep your talent here at home. You have to attract them. I don't think pro sports in and of itself is that huge driver, but it's definitely part of the mix. The arts are part of that. The idea of having local music and local beer and all those other kinds of things all together create a lifestyle, and that matters not just because it's fun for people when they're not at work, but it's very much about saying to a talented person, you can come to a city and do more than simply drive to your office, park, and drive back to your house. Okay, Milwaukee is an incredibly cool place, but it needs to make some investments right now to make it more attractive to the mobile talent that has a lot of choices right now.
When you compare the arena situation here to the, say, the Vikings stadium situation of a few years ago, the battle in Minnesota was often cast as Minneapolis versus the possibility that the Vikings could move to the suburbs right. Somewhere, whereas the issue here is the Bucks in Milwaukee, you know, versus apathy and the Bucks move to Seattle or someplace else. What would have been, aside from the ego blow to the city of Minneapolis itself, what would have been the issue if the Vikings had, you know, pulled up the stakes and moved to Arden Hills?
Yeah. I think it's incredibly important to keep these facilities within the center city where you can walk to a restaurant and create a whole experience as part of that. There are successful stadiums in suburbs, surrounded by parking lots, sometimes a restaurant or two nearby. But the fact of the matter is, you're not getting the same amount of energy out of that. You make a night out of it. And when we really saw that when the Twins' new stadium opened in downtown Minneapolis, the old one was kind of isolated. This one is right in the heart of the entertainment district. Restaurants soared. That meant that those of us who wanted to go to restaurants on non-game days had more opportunities. That meant that more housing located in there because people wanted to be in places where there's active street life.
The irony about the Twins situation, of course, is that the neighborhood around their old stadium is where the new Viking Stadium is going to be because this is where the Metrodome was.
Yeah. One of the things that we've been able to do over time in Minneapolis-St. Paul is to connect the dots by using big facilities and transit. So 15 years ago, we started a huge boom in investing in cultural institutions, Walker Art Center, Guthrie Theater. Then we moved on to the stadium piece of it with the Twins and the Vikings now, and then the University of Minnesota, and then the Wild in downtown St. Paul, all connected by a light rail line. It's not one thing. It's connecting the fabric of a community. What we did with those investments was then set off an explosion in residential development and attract now one huge company. Wells Fargo is building an enormous facility right next to the football stadium. So it became not just about a game. And the facility itself was about many activities, but the community around it became a place people wanted to live. That could have been spread out all around. Or the employee who may be thinking about working at Target in downtown Minneapolis may have gotten attracted to work at Walmart. But we say, would you rather be in a cornfield in Arkansas or would you rather be in a vibrant community? That's what you have to sell here in Milwaukee. And so you face this real opportunity if you do this right and you negotiate tough on behalf of the public. You can really create something that benefits not just somebody who goes to a basketball game, but an entire community that's attracting talent and making everybody's pocketbook a little better.
As you say, you went from one stadium issue to another stadium issue to another stadium issue to another stadium issue. Is there any way for a stadium or an arena deal to happen without an imminent threat taking place?
You know, a lot of times these conversations are put in terms of a team moving. That was happened with a couple of our stadiums, not as much with the Vikings and the Timberwolves, thankfully.
University of Minnesota wasn't going to move.
Yeah, the university was staying there. But I think part of it is there's a real ambivalence that I fully understand on the public and political leaders because this is engaging in a very imperfect situation. And I understand why a political leader or a resident of this community would be reticent about getting into this. I sure as heck was because it's not perfect. And pro sports economics are just crazy. The thing that I think people have to do is to get in front of these issues and say, okay, if we engage in this, we have to stand back from what the owners are asking and say, what do we want? And I would say, as Milwaukee and Wisconsin, you should ground yourself in the fact that you want to have a 24-hour downtown that will attract more employees, that will ground more people in living here. You want to make sure that facility is not just for basketball, which is great, but also for many, many other activities. You want to make sure that you negotiate as a tough business person would and say, okay, owner, if you're going to make something off this, the public better make some money back, and you can do that with a clawback provision. You want to make sure it's not just a isolated building, but it's very, very lively in all corners. And so you can walk around that and be part of the community. There are ways to do this thing right. And I just think that you have to love the Bucks, but you have to watch out for the public Bucks at the same time. And I think you can do both.
Well, and right now the state's in this position where the governor in his budget has included financing for an arena in Milwaukee and at the same time enormous cuts to the UW system. Is there any way to do this without it coming out as though there are winners and losers?
There are definitely ways to come out without winners and losers, and I don't know all the details of the plan here, but I do think you need to craft strategies that have those benefiting the most paying the most. The way we dealt with the city's portion in Minneapolis for the Viking Stadium, for instance, was to leverage off the sales tax that was created there and have the state give the city a larger portion of the sales tax that the state was taking. And that way, what we're doing is really able to say those people come into the bars and the restaurants, pay more, and the state had been taking a huge portion of that. So I think one of the things that's important is to not play this off other parts of it. If the governor, mayor, whatever, has to make decisions, and so there are choices. But I think you also have to look at the revenue streams that are going to grow because of this and in a best case, capture those first.
R.T. Ryback, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you. I love this city, and I'm pretty excited about having a new basketball arena so the Timberwolves could hopefully beat somebody someday. But I look forward to coming down and seeing it.
R.T. Ryback served as mayor of Minneapolis from 2002 to January of last year. He now runs an initiative called Generation Next, which seeks to close achievement gaps, and he also teaches a course called Mayor 101 at the University of Minnesota. He was in Milwaukee in February to speak at the annual meeting of the Greater Milwaukee Committee, and our interview first aired then. Keep listening. A leading national expert weighs in on why stadium or arena projects succeed or fail when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we talked with former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback about the various factors that cleared the way for four sports stadium or arena projects to take place in the 12 years he served as the city's chief executive. His experience is a relevant one as debate continues to swirl in Milwaukee over how the Bucks NBA basketball team should approach the funding of an arena to replace the BMO Harris Bradley Center, which the team and the league says is necessary. The team's owners have pledged to kick in a substantial part, and its former owner, Herb Cole, says he will contribute as well. But how the remainder would be funded is still an open question. One possibility remains a so-called jock tax called for in Governor Walker's proposed budget. Roger Knoll has some informed thoughts about all of this. Knoll is a professor emeritus of economics at Stanford University and one of the country's leading experts on public financing for sports stadiums and arenas. He joined us in February to add some perspective to the discussion. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
What are the most vital influences that make new stadiums or arenas succeed or fail?
Politics. A fairly small fraction of the population are actually diehard fans. So it's difficult to get a majority political support to subsidize in a substantial measure any kind of a new sports facility. Consequently, the industry and their supporters try to make the case that facilities add substantially to the economic conditions of the local community, which is not a correct argument, but it's important politically because it's necessary to convince at least some voters to support these things or else they would never happen.
The idea is to get enough people on board for long enough to get the project through, and then it doesn't really matter what they think.
Right. And then after the fact, when it doesn't pan out, when it turns out to be financially less of a benefit than was initially promised, by then it's too late.
Well, what have you found out in terms of whether an arena can drive development around it or vice versa, the development that exists can contribute positively or negatively towards an arena?
Well, it depends a lot on the whole context. That is to say, an arena that is used a lot, that has many things going on in it other than just the games of a professional sports team, can, in fact, produce some localized development, restaurants and bars and things like that that are nearby. Whether they do or not, however, depends on the extent to which there's actually a comprehensive plan. Indeed, in some cities, sports facilities have been part of much larger urban redevelopment schemes that maybe last over a decade. And the sports fans then become part of a much larger coalition of people. Like in Cleveland, you have not only the new sports facilities for the teams, but you have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and a new theater district, plus a lot of commercial and real estate intertwined with it for various retail trade. So downtown Cleveland was successfully redeveloped with sports as a component. But if it's not part of a better plan that has a little bit broader and longer term horizon, then there is no economic benefit for having a sports facility or a local team.
So you would say that the key difference here is that cities that look at an arena as a component have some possibility of success, whereas if people expect an arena or a stadium to be a catalyst for everything else to somehow follow, that's where they make the mistake?
That's exactly right. That is, that the if you build it, they will come story is not true. It has to be part of something bigger.
So would you say then the economics of building and maintaining a multi-purpose arena, one that would not just host one or two professional sports teams, are different than, say, a baseball-only stadium, which was the last one of these big projects that took place in Milwaukee?
Yes. No, I mean, the extreme example is a football stadium, which not only is it only used 10 times a year if you don't make the playoffs and 12 times a year if you do, but it's basically useless for almost anything else because we don't have the Beatles anymore, so we can't fill up 75,000-seat stadiums with rock concerts because there's nobody out there who can draw that many people anymore. So when you build a football stadium, from an economic perspective, you're building a black hole, that no one is going to build a new business across the street from a new football stadium for the 12 days a year when people are there. Now, the similar, it's not as bad for basketball as it is for football for two reasons. The first is the arena can be used for other things. It's one thing to try to fill 75,000 seats for a rock concert. It's nothing else to try to fill 20, because there are artists out there who can get 20,000 people. Plus, there are other things you can do in there. You can have it as a major convention site. You can do all kinds of other stuff with it. So if it's managed correctly and designed correctly, then it can be a catalyst for getting someone to build a hotel or a bar or a restaurant across the street. But it does take locating it in a place where all that would be feasible and making certain that the management of it is multi-purpose as opposed to single-purpose. Because even in the case of basketball, that's 41 days a year. And you're not going to go into business if you only have traffic 41 days a year.
The other new model we hear about often is to not just build an arena, but a virtual entertainment center that has, you know, the arena plus attached restaurants and shopping and maybe a hotel as well. Does it matter to the broader economy whether people are eating food inside an arena complex or at bars and restaurants around it?
No, that's an excellent point. What goes on in the local area around an arena is the substitution for things elsewhere. The total amount of money that people in the metropolitan area spend on entertainment and recreation doesn't go up because a basketball team is there or a new facility is there. It's just that it substitutes for other things. So that's why even in the best of cases, the central city might use the construction of an arena and other things, like you were saying, restaurants and hotels, all as part of a bigger development, as a mechanism to refurbish its declining downtown. But that will come at the expense of further development in the suburbs. So it is pretty much a zero-sum game. Unlike when I was a kid, people do not plan their vacations around going to professional sports games anymore because there are so many professional sports teams compared to eight in every league, which is what it was when I was a kid. And that kind of situation where it's not attracting people from outside to any significant degree is the fundamental reason that it's essentially a substitution for people who already live there as opposed to attracting a net increment of new business to the area.
So if you were the manager of a country club or a golf course or some other sports and entertainment kind of venue elsewhere in the Milwaukee area, would you be kind of rooting against a new arena being built?
Yes. I mean, it seems to me that what effect it's going to have on you is directly related to how far away you are from it. The further away you get from it, the more likely it is that it's going to hurt you.
The case here in Milwaukee is that the new owners of the Bucks and the NBA itself have said that a new or renovated arena is needed or the team is obligated to find a new home. And that is, of course, not all that unusual a threat in this day and age. Is there any way to that a new sports facility happens anywhere without this sort of metaphorical gun to the head?
No, it always is a metaphorical gun to the head. It's locally we just went through the same thing in Sacramento with the Kings, where they two or three proposals had to be put before the city and the voters before they finally got one that would take. But it was exactly the same phenomenon. The old owners threatened to move to Las Vegas or somewhere else, and the NBA said the old arena wasn't satisfactory, so Sacramento was going to lose its team. And it's, in the case of Sacramento, it's even a worse threat because it's literally the only major league sport in the city. So yeah, the city is put into the position of an all or nothing decision. They either have to, we call this the Taj Mahal effect in the economics of sports, that you either have to buy us the Taj Mahal or we're moving. And that threat means there's no sort of intermediate happy solution. Like, for example, it would be cheaper just to give the team some extra money every year that would be the profits from the extra seats and concessions in a new arena. So, okay, you're going to make an extra $5 million a year. Here's $5 million. we'll just give it to you. And that would be cheaper than subsidizing a new arena.
Well, give us some history on this issue, if you can. I mean, you referenced back in the days when there were eight teams in every professional league. When did taxpayers start being asked to build these new arenas and stadiums? Has this always been part of the equation?
Not always, no. The event, the interesting events took place in the 1950s. When I was 12 years old, my family planned a vacation to Chicago and Milwaukee for the purpose of going to baseball games because we lived in the West and there wasn't a baseball team within 1,000 miles of us. So we actually saw Milwaukee baseball game as tourists. And that was a common phenomenon because there were so few baseball teams then and they were all stuck in the northeast quadrant of the United States. That doesn't happen anymore. But County Stadium, was County Stadium. the first major stadium that was built with public subsidies was the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, which was built for the Olympics and then given to an NFL team to play in. And so this is a fairly recent phenomenon. It didn't turn out to be the case that professional sports got their start playing in subsidized facilities. They became subsidized when there was this huge growth in the value of sports that occurred after World War II in the 50s and 60s. And that's when we made the transition from teams being expected to build their own facilities to being helped out by a local government. The movement of the Dodgers and Giants from New York to California was in part done because the cities offered to subsidize their stadiums. In the case of the Dodgers, giving them a lot of valuable land downtown. In the case of Giants, building a park for them. And so it's old in the sense that it's 50 to 60 years ago that this happened, but it's new in the sense it reflected the transformation of professional sports from something fairly minor as just another entertainment to something that was sort of regarded as central to society. And this was, of course, created by television.
Well, and of course, it was the 50s when teams really first started moving and the
yep.
threat that a team could pick up and leave without a new stadium became real.
Yes, exactly right. The threat to move was not an important threat until the 50s and 60s. And indeed, some of the movements were, in fact, generated by television itself because all of a sudden being stuck in a constrained local television market was a serious cost. Whereas, being in Milwaukee when there's no television is not bad because Milwaukee's a reasonably sized city, but it has a constrained broadcast market. It doesn't have a huge regional broadcasting market. And consequently, the relative attraction as Milwaukee as a place to put a team was affected by the rise of television. So teams in Milwaukee would be expected through time to ask for more and more and more subsidy in order to be able to compete with the larger broadcasting markets in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco.
Now, I spoke with the former mayor of Minneapolis, and he came into office as someone who generally opposed public financing for pro and big-time college sports facilities, but four of them happened in his 12 years in office.
Yes, he changed his mind in order to keep office, right?
Well, and he talks about the key to making them work was to have what he calls a clawback provision, that if these places start making money, the city is assured of getting its fair share. Where do you come down on this idea that the city can actually make back some of what it invests in a public stadium?
Actually, there's an interesting study of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Because of the Twin Cities, there's been competition between the two cities to be the home place of professional sports teams throughout their history. And consequently, they have built more stadiums per capita than any other city in the country. And the notion that these things pay back to the city is facetious, because of the competition between the cities, the lifetime of their stadiums is short. Only about every 15 to 20 years, teams get new stadiums or arenas in the Twin Cities, and that's because of this competition. The idea about a clawback because they're going to be profitable is not valid, because if it was in fact the case that a stadium in and of itself was a profitable enterprise, then the private sector would be happy to build it. The reason that teams themselves don't want to spend $500 million to $1.5 billion on a sports facility is because it's not a profitable investment. It doesn't generate enough increment to revenue. To go for one of the current sort of Taj Mahal versions of stadiums, which cost so much because they're so elaborately appointed and they're so fancy, that incremental amount of cost is not worth it in terms of an economic return. And that's why they go for the subsidies, because no one would ever do it. Just to give you an illustration, in the Bay Area, both of the major colleges have built new football stadiums in the last few years, Stanford and Cal. And Stanford's cost about $100 million and Cal's cost about $300 million. The new stadium for the 49ers cost $1.2 billion. And the differences are not great in terms of how many people they actually seat. The difference is in all the other stuff that's in there and how fancy it is, the gold plating. And that would never happen if they had to pay for it themselves like colleges do.
It's interesting stuff. Roger Knoll, thank you so much.
Okay.
Roger Knoll is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Stanford University and Senior Fellow in the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. One of his key areas of expertise is in public financing for sports arenas. He joined us on the line from California. Another break just ahead, and then a documentary from a Wisconsin filmmaker featuring amazing work by three people to reduce hunger. It'll show later this week in Milwaukee, and we'll learn more about it in just a moment on Lake Effect. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. It is not hard to look around our community, our country, to see that for many people, food is a basic necessity they can't take for granted. Food stamps at the grocery store, reduced-price lunches in schools, lines at the food pantry. Later this week, WUWM will sponsor a showing of a documentary on the issue of food insecurity and the stories of three remarkable people and their tireless efforts to make a difference in their communities. The film is called The Starfish Throwers, and it's produced by Wisconsin native Jesse Raisler, who joined us via Skype from Minnesota. Thanks so much for joining us.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Is there a part of the story of hunger in the world that you thought wasn't being told that you were trying to address through this film?
Yeah, you know, this started a film that was reading how food is a metaphor for compassion for these amazing people that are featured in the film. And over the course of the film, what emerged for me is this idea of the starfish story, that one person can actually make a big difference through inspiring other people. So it's that idea that our impact can be greater than our individual action, sometimes without us even knowing it.
When you set out to make it, though, you said it was about this food as a metaphor for compassion. Was that what got you thinking about hunger in the first place?
You know, I I love to cook myself. My wife and I love to cook, and it's how we show people that we care for, love to cook for them. And so I was looking at, you know, food as a way of showing someone that you care for them. And I came across the story of Alan, who's based here in Minneapolis. And one night I actually saw his van driving, and very conveniently, it says love one another, but conveniently also has his phone number. So I gave him a call and said, what would you think about me just following you? I think your story is amazing. Can I bring a camera with? And at first he said, absolutely not. I'm not interested in the attention. That's not why I do this. So it actually took about a year and a half to convince him through conversations. Every once in a while we would check in to allow me to come out. But once I was with him the first time, he said, okay, it's not what he thought. He thought there'd be a big crew with lights and would be sort of disturbing to the work that he was doing, but it was just myself. And once he saw that, it was fine. And so from there, I started looking for other stories that also embodied that same work, people who are working towards a similar goal, but in a different way, and from a very different walks of life, which led me ultimately to India, to Krishnan, and then to South Carolina, to Katie. But it really all started with Alan and his story.
Well, and for folks who have not seen the movie, give us a thumbnail sketch of what each of these people does and where it fits in the equation of dealing with hunger.
Sure. So Alan is based here in Minneapolis, and he hands out over 1,000 sandwiches every single night of the year right from the back of his van. He's a retired school teacher. He had been working with kids from a young age and then slowly shifted his focus to homeless people who were on the streets of Minneapolis, had nothing to eat. And in the winter, it gets very brutal, so he'll give them tokens to ride the bus to stay warm. And he'll also problem solve with them. And that's what's different, I think, is that he asks, you know, how did you get here? What can we do to get your life back on track? And, you know, a lot of these people, other charities will provide, you know, a one-time meal or something, but they don't really get to the root at what has happened. And so I think Alan's able to help turn so many lives around because he does invest in them in this way. So as I said, it started with Alan, and then Krishnan from Madurai, India, which is Tamil Nadu, the very tip of India. He was 5-star chef. He was serving in a hotel, and then on a trip back to his hometown, saw something disturbing, which just changed his entire perspective. And he said, I have the skill of cooking. Should I sell it just for money when I can give it to my people that are starving? So he started cooking 300, 400 meals a day for people in his hometown. And that passion has grown, and he's served millions of meals now, fresh cooked, amazing meals to these people in the streets of Madurai, India. And then finally, Katie Stagliano, when she was 9, she grew a cabbage as part of a school program. The cabbage kept growing and growing to everyone's amazement, and ultimately became a 40-pound cabbage, which just really sort of blew her mind. And her parents said, what do you want to do with it? And she said, you know, could we give this to the soup kitchen and maybe it could feed some people? And so they did that, and she went and helped cook it. And it ended up serving over 200 people with one cabbage. And that just flipped this light bulb in her brain. And she's like, wow, if one cabbage can do that, what could a whole garden do? So put in a garden at home, and then her school heard about it. And they said, you know what, you can put in a garden here at the school. Farmers started hearing about the story and offering her acres to grow food. And ultimately, she has, I think it's 80 children-led gardens in something like 30 states. So this movement has really expanded. And at 16 years old now, she has a goal to have 200 gardens in all 50 states by the time she graduates high school.
One of the things that really jumped out at me as you chronicle the stories of all three of these people is that there were naysayers for all of them. And in the case of Krishnan, you know, his own family thought he had kind of gone off the deep end. And Katie hears from, anonymous strangers who think she's doing something wrong. It seems like a story of perseverance for all three of these people.
Absolutely it is. And that was what was, especially you mentioned Krishnan's story. I mean, what he's doing is really, you know, unique and special there because, you know, historically in the caste system, someone of his caste, the Brahmin, the highest caste, does not do this. They don't interact in any form with the lowest caste, the untouchables, as they're called. So for him to do this, you know, people say the caste system is really disappearing. In many ways it is, but you see illustrated through his story that it's not completely gone. I mean, it's still ingrained socially. So when he started doing this, his family, you know, even his parents, they brought in psychiatrists, black magic healers. They're like, what is wrong with you? We've given you this chance at this amazing, you know, lucrative career, and you're going to throw it away. So that was so fascinating, his backstory, to see what he had to overcome just to you know, change his life and to do this work. And Katie also, yes, she gets these letters from people saying, you're wasting your time. These people don't deserve this. There are other people who could benefit from it. So, you know, and Alan, you know, people think, a lot of people think he's crazy here, you know, for doing what he does. So they all sort of have definitely faced these uphill battles.
When the film was shown at the Milwaukee Film Festival earlier this fall, I know one issue that some people raised was whether the efforts that you portray represent a Band-Aid approach, or at least stopped short of getting into the root causes of hunger. How do you speak to the value of what these three people are doing versus going after things like, you know, income disparity and education and the other things that might play into hunger in the world?
On the surface, this might, you know, seem to someone who hasn't seen the full film, they might think it's an advocacy film or a film about hunger. But what's unique about each of these three people featured in the film is that they are doing more than that. Alan, especially, you know, the sandwich is just the beginning for him. That's the conversation starter, where he asks, how did you get here? What can we do to get your life back on track? And then he goes and becomes a creative problem solver. And it's amazing to see the lives he's turned around because he cares enough to ask those questions that nobody else really asks of these people. With Katie, you see her, you know, she's not only growing these vegetables and produce for people that are hungry, she is teaching people how to garden. She's, as you see in the film, she helps a man put a garden in his front yard as opposed to lawn that you just mow. And she also teaches cooking class for a lot of these people so that they can grow their own produce and cook their own food. And with Krishnan, it's a little bit different because he's helping people that a lot of them, the majority of them, are so severely mentally handicapped and they don't have the same services in India as we do in America for those people. So he really is just, it's survival mode. And a lot of them can hold down additional jobs. That's why opening the Akshay Home is such a big deal for him, because now he's a place where these people can come and at least contribute in whatever way they can, in terms of peeling the vegetables for the meal or help cleaning the facility so that they feel that they're contributing, whereas they might not be able to hold down, you know, a traditional job in larger society. So I think that, you know, really, you know, the idea for that criticism, I think, you know, my hope for this film isn't that it's saying, here's how we solve hunger. It's not at all. It's more about reconnecting with our own, you know, ability to affect positive change on the world at large. And when you think about, is an issue too big? And what can one person really do? I think their stories serve as an inspiration to show, like, wow, you know, our impact can really be greater than our own individual action. And that, remember that every big change starts with one really small act. And I think each of these stories, you know, serve to illustrate that.
And I would imagine that, you know, you might have some concern that someone might see this movie and see what, you know, forces of nature these three people are and say, oh, my goodness, there's no way in the world that I could make that kind of a difference. But if I get what you're saying correctly here, it's not necessarily about being one of these three people. It's about just starting somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's seeing where they started. It always started with something small that grew into something much bigger. And, you know, peripherally, we show all the people that sort of rally around each of these three central figures, you know, people that make this. So it can be as simple as getting a few people together and making some sandwiches. It can be as simple as, you know, you say you have a garden at your home, maybe you plant an extra row of something. So we can each contribute in different small ways. So it's not to say we all have to be the next Alan or Katie or Krishna, forces of nature, what they've been able to do. But it just, I think, reminds us that, you know, one small act can inspire other people. And then slowly, all of a sudden, these seismic changes start happening.
Well, Jesse Raisler, it is a great film. And thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me on today.
Wausau native Jesse Raisler is the producer of the documentary The Starfish Throwers, which will show Wednesday evening at the UWM Union Theater. The screening is sponsored by WUWM and the Hunger Task Force. Raisler will be part of a panel discussion following the film, and food donations to the Hunger Task Force will be collected as well. You can find out more about the film and how to get tickets to the screening at WUWM.com. One last break, and we'll check in with gardening contributor Melinda Myers about how you might have saved all that water from the now melted snow. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Did you spend any time working in your yard over the weekend? We are in that great period of time right now where we can enjoy the warm weather without yet worrying about mowing the lawn. But gardening contributor Melinda Meyer says that doesn't mean we should ignore our yard as the last piles of snow disappear. Melinda Myers, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here, and with a little bit of sunshine and slightly warmer temperatures, it's a great time to start planning and thinking about gardening.
If you haven't already taken some kind of action to do so, it's probably a little late to be saving the melting snow out there. But let's talk about ways that you can save natural water for use in your garden or in your containers.
You know, snow may be one of those elusive things, but buckets or troughs or things where you can throw the snow instead of in the street or, you know, on your yard. But if it's on your yard, once the ground thaws, it will go and recharge the groundwater. So that's great. You don't want to save snow that's been treated with de-icing salt. Some gardeners like to throw a scoop of snow on every one of their containers that they're overwintering. So as it melts, it waters that container. So you're sure the roots don't dry out. But it's also a good time to evaluate where's that water collecting? Because if you're going to have standing water in the spring, you're going to want to either select plants carefully or maybe resolve the issue. You know, a French drain or a cistern might be the answer, you know, a large vessel to collect water, and that way you can use it when you need it. Or a French drain where you dig a trench, fill it with gravel, put some weed barrier down, cover that with soil, and then you can grow plants on top. That allows that water to drain much more quickly, so you don't have that standing water that causes root rot and decline in your plants.
So what you're saying is that this is actually an opportunity. If we see places where there's a lot of water standing, we know that this is likely to be an issue come summertime when we have a heavy rainfall.
You bet. And so it's a chance to really look and evaluate your plantings, not only how they're going to make it through the winter, because wet feet in the winter is a really a sure sign that those plants are going to struggle or maybe die, perennials. And again, in the summer, too, kind of watch those water patterns. We can't really – we don't want to change the direction of water so it becomes someone else's problem. But if we can collect water from hard surfaces, from the roof, or create those French drains so it goes down into the ground and recharges our groundwater, or maybe it's time to put a rain garden in. And that's a great way to capture that water and, again, filter it through the soil, have a beautiful garden, and recharge our groundwater.
Now, you mentioned the idea of a cistern, and folks, I think, are familiar with the term. They're also familiar with the concept of a rain barrel. Is there, technically speaking, a difference between those two?
I think size is one of the things. Rain barrels, we usually think of much smaller, 55, 100 gallons, something that you can easily maneuver and capture water off your rain. A cistern may be something that, you know, in the old days, they had them built into the basements and they'd channel all the water from around the house there and collect it. Now you can buy large cisterns. They're larger containers, plastic or fiberglass that can be buried underground so you don't have to look at them. Or I've even seen some that almost look like silos behind large buildings. And the idea is, again, collecting that water where it normally would run off into the storm sewer, collect it for use later, whether it's for watering the garden or, you know, a lot of different things people are using that water. But mainly we think of taking care of our lawn and landscape because we use a lot of water for that purpose. And anytime we can capture that water, keep it from putting too much pressure on our storm sewer. That's really what we're worried about here because it's a lot of rain or none. So that way we can kind of manage the water before it ends up creating a problem.
Now, for folks who want to take a smaller step and don't necessarily need a full-size cistern, but they're interested in something like a rain barrel, there are rain barrels that come in a variety of sizes and fanciness, if you will. What should we look for when we're choosing one?
You know, good point. Here are some of the basics. Budget's really a very personal thing. And you've found ways to hide your garbage can. You can find ways to mask your rain barrel. So if you look at the price of those other fancy, prettier ones, and it's not in your budget, you can find a way to either paint or manage the rain barrels. So a couple things. The spigot should be very low on the barrel because it empties by gravity. So if there's very little water collecting on the bottom, you don't have the stagnating water. You should have an overflow because you can really fill a 55-gallon drum quickly. So you want that so that when it does fill, it overflows either out into a garden, out into the yard, or even hook up several rain barrels so they overflow into each other. Usually they either have a hole in the top so your downspout goes right into it or a screen so your downspout empties into it, but it keeps twigs and, you know, reduces bugs and things like that. You don't need to worry about mosquitoes. You can throw what's called a mosquito dunk or mosquito flakes, and they're basically BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, a strain that kills only the larvae of of mosquitoes and fungus gnats and black flies. So you throw that in there, and it lasts for 30 days. And if your pets or a wildlife drink that water, it won't hurt anything. It's organic, and it's very specific in terms of what it treats.
But presumably, if the downspout is going directly into it, you don't have to worry about this at all.
Exactly. And then elevate it, because it does empty by gravity. So by elevating it, you speed the way it empties. Now, a lot of people will hook up a soaker hose and put it in their garden if it's nearby. But remember, if it's gravity fed, the further from the barrel, the less pressure. So short runs, 25 feet or less. And then you may even want to put a pump on there, a solar pump or an electrical pump that will help push that water through so you have even pressure as you water the garden. Or just use it to fill your watering can and water your containers.
Good things to remember. So as you mentioned, as we get things going this morning, the temperature has warmed up. We're seeing more of the sunshine. The snow has all but disappeared in some places and is still disappearing from the enormous piles in the parking lots. And the temptation might be to go out there and start doing stuff. What should we be doing now and what should we not be doing now?
You know, lightly rake your lawn wherever the snow is collected. That will help fluff it up, dry it out, and reduce the risk of snow mold. Snow mold occurs in areas where the snow tends to linger. We can get out and do our pruning. So summer blooming shrubs that may need a little bit of work, now's the time. You can see the ground. You can make some good choices in pruning. Wait until after forsythia, lilac, bridal wreath, spirea bloom to prune if you want the flowers. Clean up. If you left your perennial stand for winter, now you can start cutting them back to the ground, composting that material. Kind of check and see how things did over winter. That early season freeze and thaw, some things like coral bell, daylilies and bulbs may have been pushed out of the ground. Gently tamp those back in so that they'll be ready to go once they start rooting and really take off with the season. And then keep an eye. That quick temperature drop we experienced in November might cause some problems on our plants, and it's really a wait and see. So if in doubt, leave it intact, and you can always prune it out later if it was winter killed.
Well, and speaking of quick temperature drops, we are at a time of year when that really could happen again.
Oh, you bet. And so really a slow, gradual warm-up, even though gardeners hate it, is best for the plant. So we want to hope for a slow, gradual warm-up. You know, if things start growing and blooming, you know, you can throw a blanket on top of perennials or a sheet or some Remay to protect anything you think might be damaged by the cold temperatures. Trees and shrubs, let's hope those buds hold tight because that will protect them with those temperature drops. But many trees will produce adventitious buds. So if their first flush of buds are killed by the cold temperatures, many times they'll develop a second flush. So don't give up.
And probably still too early to think about fertilizing.
You bet. Fertilizing frozen ground is bad for our water, so make sure the ground is thawed. If you're going to do your lawn, wait till Memorial Day. Bulbs, as they're peeking through the ground, a good time to fertilize them.
Melinda Myers, let's talk again soon.
You bet. Thanks, Mitch.
Melinda Myers is our regular gardening contributor. She is the author of numerous books on gardening, including month-by-month gardening in Wisconsin, and she's host of Melinda's Garden Moments on television. You can find a link to her website from WUWM.com. That's where you can find her growing schedule of public appearances, including this weekend's Realtors Home and Garden Show. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for being with us today. I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.